Zion and Sons Building Company. I assume you've all read the chapter, so I'll expect that you can probably tell me what it's about. But I did want to follow up from last time. There was a very serious question about page 228, and the one word, sour. Subsequent generations also did not keep the covenant of the law. Sour. Now, just before class, we heard some pretty awful puns. Thank you, Bobby. But I did ask my father about this particular insertion, and I'll just say that it's related to the fact that the conversation takes place in a Chinese restaurant and refers to ducks.
What?
So that's the explanation, okay?
I don't get it.
You're not supposed to, I don't think.
In other words, he made a mistake, but he doesn't want to...
No, no, it's not a mistake. Oh. It's not a mistake.
What are we talking about since I wasn't here? I mean,
it's unexpected, but it's not a mistake.
Well, what does it mean?
Sour.
You didn't get it, that mistake?
Well, what do you have in a Chinese restaurant?
Sweet and sour soup.
Yes, duck sauce, sweet and sour sauce. So it's just supposed to be referring to that whole context.
Oh.
I hope it enhances your experience of that chapter.
That's almost as funny as Latin jokes.
Of course, it comes in an appropriate place because it's talking about people not keeping God's covenant, which is a sour thing to do. So, anyways, we'll move on from that, and we can probably get right into this chapter unless there are any other comments or questions from last time. Apparently not. So, Zion and Sons Building Company. What is the main issue in this chapter?
The foundation.
The foundation. The foundation of what?
Of the faith.
Okay. Whenever you build something, you need a foundation. And the scriptures talk about this in various places. Yeshua told parables about wise and foolish builders and what they built on. More specifically, does anyone want to say what foundation is being discussed in this chapter? What question is being considered?
The fact of whether Yeshua is the Mashiach or not. Mm-hmm. And if he is, who is he?
Okay, that's related. Anyone else?
The passage in, I don't remember where it is, but where Yeshua asked, who do men say that I am? And then he asked, who do you say that I am?
Mm-hmm.
And Peter's response, that passage.
Okay, yeah, and it's right there. You can read it if you like. Maybe it's the third or fourth paragraph on the first page from Matthew 16.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to read that?
All right. Shimon Kefa answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the Living God." Yeshua responded to him, "Blessed are you, Shimon Bar Yonah. The flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I also tell you that you are Kefa, and on this rock I will build my congregation, and the gates of Sheol will not prevail against it."
Mm. Now, this has become an important verse for various reasons,
mm-hmm.
but that's the basic question that's being discussed. What is the rock on which Yeshua is building his kehillah, his assembly, his congregation?
That he is the Messiah, the Son of the Living God.
Okay. Certainly it's related to that because that's what precedes it immediately. Shimon Kefa saying that. So definitely that is an important element. But the chapter is basically concerned with discussing that question. And to start out, we could just quickly summarize how people have looked at this statement. What's the most common interpretation of this scripture?
The
Christian Messiah said Yeshua said to Peter, "You are the rock."
Mm-hmm. Right.
That I would build my church on. I mean, the whole Pope thing is built on that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a Catholic view.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think there are probably more Protestants than Catholics.
Yeah.
But the Protestants You don't they have the same view about that?
No, we do not.
Not at all.
Big division.
Well, let's stick with the Catholic view for a moment, because the Catholic view dominated for 1,500 years or so, and influenced people who aren't even Christian to this day. So a lot of people who have heard something about the Bible but are not Catholic think that there's this scripture that talks about Peter being a rock and the first pope. In some translations, maybe that's what it says, "Blessed are Shimon Bar Yonah, for you shall be the first pope." However, in other translations, it's different. So we should try to look at what it says, of course, but keeping in mind how it's been used. The Catholic interpretation is that there's this wordplay, of course, on the name Peter, Petros, which means rock, and that with this statement, Jesus was declaring Peter to be the foundation of the church. And therefore, all of the anything that was built from that point on had to come directly from Peter. So the Catholic claim to this day is that all the popes, right up until the current one, come in a direct line of, I guess you could say, apostolic succession or something like that, from Peter, the first pope. That he's the one who bestows the leadership and the ability to do that. What are some of the... Is this a good argument, by the way? It's been convincing for a long time. What are some of the pros and cons of the argument?
Well, it all has to do with that Petros, that he's saying the rock, and you're the rock, and so that's what based on what as your father goes on to say, that this was, of course, written in Hebrew, and it's not, that's the Greek. And the Hebrew, what does Kepha mean in Hebrew?
What does Kepha mean in Aramaic?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay.
It also means a stone, yeah.
Okay, so I guess that's, you know, so that's what they've used, that he's saying...
Right.
On this rock.
So there is some evidence that seems to support it. That's the in favor of the Catholic interpretation.
But more so in Greek than in Hebrew.
Okay.
Or
right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, why would you be skeptical about this viewpoint then? Maybe the Catholic Church is right, and maybe everything that Jesus wanted to build comes from Peter.
I don't think so.
Well, given this interpretation, if you take the interpretation, a literal interpretation from the Greek, it's a valid interpretation to say upon him. But there's nothing else supporting it, and there's also a lot of other verses that say Jesus is the way. Jesus is the Son of God.
Okay.
Jesus is the foundation.
It's, right, and it's problematic for Peter to be the foundation for that reason, and it's problematic historically and biblically to look at him that way because he's not portrayed that way in the scriptures.
Because he's Jewish.
And well, also, yes, also there's an issue of his
that's
nature.
The biggest thing, because, and your father quotes it there are no denominational actions that seek the restoration of the Davidic kingdom as their first priority, which was the priority of any of the Jews that were following him, was the restoration of the Davidic kingdom, as well as the actual Mashiach, the king of the Jews. I mean, this is who they were waiting for all their lives and throughout history.
Okay, so... The Catholic interpretation as it developed definitely changed the orientation of what Yeshua was doing.
And to me, it's not what he said. It's who said it to whom. Because if somebody else affirmed it to Yeshua, then it's very clear that they were talking about Yeshua.
Okay.
But if he said it to Peter, then it's very clear that he was talking to Peter.
Okay.
So it's a matter of who said, who called who to what.
So this supports the Catholic viewpoint, though, then? Is that what you're saying?
If the documentation is that it is something that Yeshua said to Peter, then that supports the Catholic statue. But if it is, and that is that I got the Greek translation phrases it like that.
Okay.
But in Hebrew, it was somebody else that affirmed it to Yeshua that you are the rock. So they were talking to Yeshua.
No, it was still Peter.
But he wasn't saying it to Peter.
Yeah, yes, he was. Yeshua's response was to Peter. Peter responded first to Yeshua's questions, and then Yeshua responded to Peter.
But Yeshua didn't say to Peter, you are the rock. Well, that's well, not controversial.
You are
Catholics
a stone.
That that's what he said. And well, Protestants don't. And Protestants think that that's not what he meant. That what he meant was this statement that Peter made about Yeshua being the Messiah, the Son of the Living God. That was the rock upon which the congregation would be built.
Correct.
On the Messiah, not on him. Not on Peter.
On Messiah's identity. Yeshua's identity as Messiah and the Son of the Living God.
Right. And I agree with you, but I have a question. Why did the Lord even... I mean, he calls Peter the rock. You know, you are the rock, okay? And he says, I'm going to call you Peter. Okay. Okay, so how do you want to put it? Either way, why... It wouldn't be this confusion if he hadn't said that. My point is he saying that Peter, you have shown the faithfulness so of your faithfulness in this matter makes you a rock. And you know what I'm saying? Why does he even call him a rock at the same time?
Okay, that's a good question. And Vicky started to raise the Protestant interpretation too, which we can do next. But let's just consider what Herto was saying first. What does the scripture actually say, regardless of the interpretations? It says, it has Yeshua telling Peter... I tell you that you are Kepha, which is a name that he went by, mm-hmm. and that Yeshua mm-hmm. called him elsewhere as well, which means the meaning of that name is a stone. And on this rock I will build my congregation, and the gates of Sheol will not prevail against it. So Yeshua does not explicitly say to Peter, you are the rock on which I will build my congregation. Nowhere does he say that. But he is speaking to Peter when he says this. Yeah. When he makes this comment, it's in response to what Peter has said. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's room for these different interpretations, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Now, the next question, why does he call him Kepha? Is it just to add confusion to our lives?
Perhaps.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Sometimes it seems like the Lord wants to be crystal clear about some things, and sometimes it seems like he doesn't want to be so clear about other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, we have excerpts of conversations that are recorded, so we don't always have, you know, everything that transpired. Mm-hmm. First of all, keep in mind, this is what Yeshua called him, so he was referring to him as his name. Mm-hmm. And whether... You know, it's maybe a little bit hard to tell if this particular usage of his name was intended to mean something much greater, you know, allegorically. The reason that it seems to is because of the juxtaposition to the next statement, on this rock. So that's why people think that he wasn't just saying, oh, by the way, you, Peter, you know, let me tell you something. They think he was using it in a deeper way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
But I think Vicky's right that we can't necessarily know for sure. Does that answer the question? I don't know. Am I missing something there?
I mean, what I'm getting is that it's a reminder for him and for others of the statement that he made. That to say... You're the kind of person that has the faith that is needed, you know, the faith that he's talking about in that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's like a reminder to say, so he remembers that.
Okay, I think that's possible, at least. Does anyone else have thoughts on that? No?
Well, one thought might be that when... Yeshua says, I tell you that you are Kepha. Maybe rather than trying to give him a new name, maybe he was just trying to describe a characteristic of him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I tell you that you are stony or rocky mm-hmm. or hard as a rock.
Which can be interpreted in various ways.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Hard-headed, stiff-necked.
I was looking for this other place where It occurs, and it's back in Yochanan, John 1:42. It's a very interesting passage. It takes place long before this one. So it's one way we can know that it's not, you know, it's not the first time that Yeshua was calling Peter Kepha, a rock or a stone. And so it's not as though he was instituting something totally new, at least with this statement. He wasn't making some amazing new point with this statement, at least.
What verse?
Starting with verse 40. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what Yochanan had said and who had followed Yeshua. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Shimon and tell him, "We have found the Mashiach." That is Ho Christos, the anointed one. And he brought him to Yeshua. Yeshua looked at him and said, "You are Shimon, son of Yochanan. You will be called Kepha," which when translated is Petros, a stone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, in other words, Yeshua's naming of Peter, or his use of this name to refer to Peter, is something that goes back a few years.
Yeah.
It doesn't originate with this particular passage. That's why I say it's hard to know whether Yeshua used it specifically in order to link it to what follows, or whether he was just, you know, as we do sometimes in our speech, using the person's name in talking to them. But it may be linked to what follows, and certainly in the Catholic interpretation it is viewed as being linked. Anything else about the Catholic interpretation that we have to mention?
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing with what we think of theology comes through. I mean, that they think that if Peter was the head of, in the first pope and all that, then the church then takes on all the blessings that were given to the Jewish people. It's kind of like he brings it over, and thus the Jewish people don't matter anymore, in fact, they should be done away with.
Right, it's part and parcel of the whole package. Yes, I agree. And so this is one of the ways in which that whole replacement is carried out. But it is a specific issue, too. And so the specific way in which they deal with this particular verse has to do with, you know, the top authority in the church and how the church is to be built itself. I think what you and other people have pointed out is that even if they thought the church was supposed to be built on Peter, the subsequent history of the Catholic Church shows that they completely departed from Peter, as Bobby was saying. You know, they didn't follow in any way the character or life of Peter in building the church. But their claim is that there's this unbroken lineage of authority that goes directly from Yeshua to Peter and on through the popes. Now, what is the Protestant interpretation of the verse? Obviously, the Protestants can't agree with this, otherwise they couldn't be Protestants.
Well, going back to the,
they'd have to be
moment,
Catholics.
For a moment, going back to the unbroken succession of popes idea, it seems that the process they've used has been that a new pope has been elected by a group of cardinals, I believe. So it's kind of like a democratic process.
It's as if it no longer applies, almost.
Right. Whereas Yeshua spoke directly to Peter, and if their argument was that Yeshua handed to Peter the keys of the kingdom and so forth, and then Peter should have then handed them over to somebody else, and that person to another person, and so on, and not end up with this situation where there's no pope for a while, and this board of people, this group of people, has to decide who the next pope was going to be.
Right. So even if their interpretation is correct, it's kind of been broken. It no longer really applies.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah. Okay, so how do the Protestants view this verse?
I guess like I've been saying, that it's the faith that he... In the belief that he is the Messiah and the Son of the Living God. I should say more that he is the Christ, the Son of the Living God.
Okay. Right. Many Protestant churches respond that Jesus was declaring Peter's declaration of faith in him to be the foundation of the church. Mm-hmm. They claim to be that church, ecclesia, that was built upon Peter's declaration of faith. Mm-hmm. I say the Catholics and the Protestants are both wrong. Let's look at the text.
Oh, come on.
It's a good idea, actually, to look at the text. And if you remember, one of the points of going through all those chapters in part one, where we break down certain previous ideas, was to be able to just read the text, which hopefully we're doing now. Of course, we have to be aware of our own potential biases and so forth. But one of the important things, I think, about reading a not exactly chronological text, but more or less chronological text, like the Bible, in the sense that, you know, it covers hundreds or even thousands of years, actually, is that we can read it forwards. We don't have to read it backwards. We don't have to start near the end. Mm-hmm. So when we talked about the word ecclesia, one of the points that I made in class and that I think was in the book was that it was not a new concept. God had given hundreds of passages already prior to this time, yep, where he talked about his kahal, mm-hmm, and building his kahal and what it would be and what it would represent. So that's the first part of the context of understanding this verse, I think. If Yeshua is talking about a foundation for his kahal, we should already have in our minds an understanding of what kahal he is talking about, because God has referred to it in hundreds of passages previously. Yep. So that's one reason why the Catholic and Protestant interpretations of this verse may be wrong, because they both assume that it's something new that's being started here, that the church is being founded, that Jesus wants to start a new thing called the church, and so he needs a new foundation for it. That's kind of problematic, I think, if you're looking at it in the context of the whole scriptures. Yeshua, as he said, did not come to abolish, but to fulfill what was written previously. So Yeshua is actually going to build in a way that's consistent with what God has already said, of course. So the context for understanding the assembly that he talks about when he says, on this rock I will build my congregation or my assembly, the context for understanding that has to be the context of the whole of the scriptures, all of Tanakh, prior to that point in time. So there's one hint immediately that both the Catholics and Protestants may be wrong in their interpretation of the verse. But there are other reasons too. What are some of the other problems with looking at this verse, let's say, from a Protestant perspective? Or do you think the Protestant perspective is correct? You can argue for either side.
No, I'm just trying. I mean, the big thing is that, you know, still the focus is off of the Jews. I mean, that's all both of them, but even though the Protestants think they're in line with the scriptures rather than the Catholics.
Okay, well, why does the focus have to be on the Jews?
Because the Jews are he's the king of the Jews, the Messiah of the Jews.
Okay. But I mean, haven't we focused on the Jews enough?
No, you can't. I mean, perhaps there's no enough.
Not the Jews, but the Messiahship.
Well, yeah.
We're not concentrating on the fact that Jesus is the Messiah.
Yeah, but he's the Messiah of the Jews.
The Jewish Messiah.
He is the Jewish Messiah, and the Gentiles come into that.
Well, I think you're going to have to go over to 1 Peter 2, verse 4. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by men but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Yeshua the Messiah. For in the scripture it says, "See, I lay the stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builder rejected has become the capstone, and the stone that causes men to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall."
Mm-hmm. And where's that from? It's quoted. quoting?
First, where's it from?
Peter, First Peter 2.
No, but where is Peter quoting from?
Isaiah.
Mm-hmm. Isaiah 28:16.
It's always about Isaiah.
I lay a stone in Zion as a foundation, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who trusts will never be dismayed. So God is God has already spoken of a cornerstone that will be the foundation stone
and a living stone.
And right, and this is repeated in the Messianic writings. Just to go back, we'll follow up on that. That's, I think, the main point, actually, of the chapter. Mm-hmm. But just to go back a little bit to what we were looking at before, I think, actually, it is a good point that the Protestant interpretation leaves out the Jewishness, not just because we want to always be Jewish or something like that, but because if it's true that God has already spoken about his kahal, then he's talking about a kahal that is essentially Jewish, that he is built with the Jewish people.
Yep.
So if you're talking about building the kahal of God in that biblical context, then you can't remove the Jewishness. It's not just ethnocentrism or something like that. It's simply the biblical presentation. So what that exactly means may become a little clearer in the next chapter on the Commonwealth of Israel. But it is an important point to keep that in if we're talking about Yeshua's kahal. Now, the more substantive point that's maybe newer to this chapter, I guess, both of them are substantive points, but the newer point in this chapter is what Bobby read about God already prophesying a foundation. And we read that passage. Any thoughts on this and how that would lead us to interpret the scripture in Matthew? Matthew 16 and Yeshua's statement to...
I do have another thought about it.
Kepha, okay.
Well, if you go to Acts 2:14 and 10:22, you'll see that Jesus gives Peter the authority and the other apostles the authority to preach the gospel, not to be the gospel.
Mm.
So I think that's an important point to bring up as well.
Can you give those again, please?
Acts 2:14 mm-hmm. and 10:22.
On the surface of it, without even going to specific scriptures, does it make sense for Peter's declaration of faith, for some words that Peter speaks, to be the foundation on which the assembly of God would be built?
No.
He was above it.
Why not?
He was above it.
Okay, he's not perfect. That's one reason.
He's not God.
He's not God. That's another reason.
He didn't die for our sins.
He didn't? Okay.
He doesn't sit at the right hand of God.
Right. Okay.
He's not the Messiah.
But
what he said was true.
What he said was true, yeah. Exactly. So.
And truth, you know, the foundation is going to include truth.
Mm-hmm.
But you say that too, don't you? Does that make you the foundation? Do you say that Yeshua is the Messiah?
Well, I think in that.
Are you the foundation?
No. Yeshua's Messiahship would be the foundation.
Okay, I thought you would. I said Peter would be.
Right.
Correct, but each of us who believes in Messiah are another stone in that kahal.
Yeah.
We are the building stones. We are, in that sense. I mean, metaphorically speaking, we could say that we are. But clearly, Peter had no authority that Yeshua hadn't given him, and that he had no authority, he had no ability, no way to heal to save us or to save anyone. He couldn't save himself without Messiah. Mm-hmm. So clearly, when he's talking about, you know, you are the stone on which I will build my kahal, my congregation, he's talking about the faith of what he has recognized, the faith that he recognized him as the Son of God, as the Mashiach.
Did he say you are the rock, or did he say this is the rock?
This is the rock.
You are this the rock. On this rock I will build.
Yeah.
So, sorry, right, he doesn't even say this is the rock.
Instead of faith being the rock.
Yeah. Right, but faith is the rock.
Right, but we were discussing how essentially, the Catholics view Peter as the rock. The Protestants view the declaration of faith as the rock. But in this chapter, a different answer is proposed, which is related to scriptures in Isaiah and in 1 Peter and elsewhere in the Gospels where Yeshua speaks about himself. Essentially, the passage which talks about the cornerstone. and the cornerstone being the foundation stone, the stone that the builders rejected. Yeshua himself being the foundation of mm-hmm. the assembly of living stones. That's what Bobby read from 1 Peter.
And the Catholics will also point out that Peter's name means rock as well, and that Yeshua was making a play on words.
Right, right.
I guess I'm late, you know. Okay, move on.
I think you can translate it in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek that you are Kepha could also be translated you are a rock.
Right.
Just a singular rock.
Saying, yeah.
Right. I think here in the chapter it implies that it would not be a wordplay in Hebrew or Aramaic. Some people think it would be a wordplay in Hebrew or Aramaic as well. It's hard to say. We don't know exactly what was said. We have the translation. But it certainly could have been. That's part of the problem. That's why there's this room for a bit of ambiguity. I think, though, that if you forget about the interpretations that have been made, and just think about it from a biblical perspective, forget about what the Catholics have said and what the Protestants have said. By the way, the Protestants have given their interpretations in response to the Catholics,
yeah,
because they had to come up with an alternate interpretation. So mm-hmm. theirs is very motivated as well. So take away those interpretations and just think about the scriptures forward instead of backwards in terms of the context of what God has said in terms of his kehilah and in terms of the foundation, his own foundation and so forth. I think if you look at it that way, it does make more sense to first go to scriptures like Isaiah 28, where God talks about the precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. And then I'm reading on page 236 of Copernicus, continuing with that. The next verse, I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. So God is talking about a building metaphorically being his righteous kingdom. He's going to have a cornerstone that is the foundation of this building. And to put the foundation stone in place to build the building, he'll use building tools, a measuring line, and a plumb line, which are essential to building a good building, as anyone who has built anything knows. And nowadays they're called tape measures and levels. But in any event, that's the analogy that's being used. And what does God use for a measuring line?
Justice.
Justice. And for a plumb line, righteousness. So he's talking about a special kind of building. And of course, many of the prophecies of Isaiah are fulfilled in Yeshua. Some of them have yet to be fulfilled. But certainly when it's talking about a building of this nature, I think we could say that it's related to the Messiah and the Messianic Kingdom. Do we agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, for that reason, if we didn't know what the Catholics and the Protestants and everyone else says, we would probably go right to a passage like this to interpret it. Questions, comments, objections?
I object to the high taxes we pay in Montgomery County. he meant about the book.
Well, I mean, one day there will be justice, but that day has not yet come. I did mean about the book, though, yes.
Okay. You got to be specific.
I guess to me it doesn't seem like there's that much of a difference between the Protestant interpretation and the interpretation that you and your father are proposing.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the fact of going back to the whole point of that by not calling him not acknowledging messiahship,
the Jewishness,
right. The Jewish part has been cut off and not been the main focus.
Right, and it starts from a different point also.
Exactly.
Looking at the scriptures. Looking at Yeshua's statement in the context of Tanakh, in the context of the scriptures,
yeah,
and going from that point, if you go from that point, you can't lose the Jewishness, and you also,
right,
you know, have the appropriate context for understanding specific things like a foundation stone or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it does start from a different place. I would say it's closer to the Protestant interpretation than to the Catholic one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's probably true. But, for example, I don't think the Protestant interpretation makes reference to these passages in Isaiah. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some Protestants do. But I don't think so. I think, see, that it's kind of, it's almost as if the Protestants tried to find a technicality. And they said these words of Peter. And so the focus is not on Yeshua himself being the foundation, but this confession of faith by Peter is the foundation. These words that he spoke are the foundation. So there is a difference in content there, too.
But his words were a statement of truth about Yeshua.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And about specifically about Yeshua's identity.
Yes.
But it has to do with terminology. Again, I know for myself, I never heard, heard Messiah once in a while, but, you know, it was mm-hmm. always, you know, Christ, you're the Christ. And mm-hmm. So I think that's the whole point going back to, by not having Messiah there, you're cutting the Jewish roots out. And, of course, you can't have the faith without the Jewish roots.
Right. There is that, too. I mean, usually in any Christian interpretation, there's a lack of an understanding of what a Messiah is, which is one of the things we talked about in a previous mm-hmm. chapter, asking mm-hmm. Australians, hey, mate, what's a Messiah?
We've got a map of Australia there now.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in Hebrew.
It's New Zealand on there, too.
Nice. New Zealand.
All the cities are in Hebrew, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Is that going to help us understand the Messiah better?
Well, ask an Australian, maybe. If they learn Hebrew, it'll help them understand the Messiah better.
Right. So I do think that is one side of it, that the Messiahship and the Jewishness is lost. Mm-hmm. But the content is a little bit different, too. It's not entirely different, but it's a little bit different in terms of the identity of the foundation and the source of the interpretation, where the interpretation actually comes from. Does it come from denying the Catholic position, or does it come from looking at previous prophecies that are related? So I would say those are the two other differences. Yes.
I would say that the Protestant churches have taken the statement, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and have not understood Messiahship and have kind of ignored it, and have faithfully taught that Jesus is the Son of the living God. They mm-hmm. have stuck to that, and
right.
that's all they've taught.
That's very interesting.
But the Catholics have taught that Peter is Jesus' representation on earth now, but that he was very clearly Jewish, the king of the Jews. That Jesus was very clearly the king of the Jews.
The Catholics but don't teach that.
Yes, they do.
They do? Okay.
Well,
yes, they do.
In a
it's
literal
like
sense.
Crucifix.
They
right. Yeah, but Jews. They don't make much of it.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't emphasize it.
It's just
not
words.
Where I came from.
Oh, wow. Right. Not that I know.
No, I mean, it's kind of like that was then and this is now.
Mm-hmm. Every Easter
has I and
I. King of the Jews.
Well,
you know what?
Yeah, but they don't view him as currently the king of the Jews anymore.
Right, exactly.
No, he's still on the cross.
Well, you know, the thing, one of the things that I thought was very interesting was what I heard his grandmother had told her. Mm-hmm. She saw the persecution of the Jews coming mm-hmm. in Germany and some of the pogroms that had gone on there. Mm-hmm. And she said, God help us for when we attack God's people, it will come back to get us. Mm-hmm. So I think clearly, at least in the Bavarian town where Herta was, yeah. and the Catholic school system that was there, they understood there was a Jewishness mm-hmm. about Yeshua and about his relationship as the Jewish Messiah.
Okay. Good.
But I also believe they firmly believe that the Pope was the leader of their yeah. of their cabal.
The judge, right? But yeah. as far as Jesus was concerned, every crucifix has I and our I. And we always knew very clearly it was King of the Jews.
I-N-R.
I-N-R.
I
would say it was
Latin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Now, it's good also to distinguish, though, between the official theological position and individual people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I mean, in every denomination, you can find individual people who have recognized what God says about Israel and the Jews mm-hmm. and have devoted their lives to love Israel and to serve the Jewish people. But that doesn't mean that the official theology of their mm-hmm. denomination accords with their belief. Oftentimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So it is helpful to distinguish between those two things. In the case of the Catholic Church, in this particular issue, I think it was something that was customary to repeat this, and so maybe that's how certain people like your grandmother could pick up on it. But for most of the theology and most of the people in the Catholic Church, they didn't understand Jesus' Jewishness, Yeshua's Jewishness. Also, I think we should recognize the interrelationship of all these different issues. You know, whenever we look at a particular issue in a chapter, it's related to all the other issues. You know, it was this whole system that was constructed, you know, of a replacement type of Christianity. And so all the different issues are intermingled. You know, they're all interrelated in some way. But there are the specific issues, too. So in this particular case, with regard to just the interpretation of the particular passage, it led in both Catholicism and Protestantism to, you know, not only pages and pages of commentary, but also much broader views, you know, related to the whole system of the religion. But it, again, we can just look at it as a specific issue of what Yeshua was saying in this particular verse. We don't necessarily have to bring in all the other issues at the same time. It's fine if they come in. I just mentioned that, though, in terms of the chapter, because the chapter isn't really addressing all of these other questions that we're raising. Okay, did anyone else want to follow up on that, or could we move on a little bit?
It reminds me of something else that Yeshua said about something about tearing down this temple and rebuilding it in 3 days. Something to that effect. And so I think he used the, I think he said this temple, apparently referring to himself or his body.
Right.
And this time he's using this rock. In a similar way.
That's very interesting. Not everything that Yeshua said was immediately clear, even to the people who knew him best. In fact, they quite often did not understand him, as we can read. And that's a good case. He was apparently, I think, standing by the temple saying, tear down this temple, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And everyone thought he was crazy, because how could you rebuild such a temple in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So this may be a similar instance. Thanks for pointing that out. And he did often refer to himself in a, I don't know if disguised way is the right terminology, but in a, in a kind of hidden way, or in the third person sometimes. And I mean, for most of, his ministry, he repeatedly told people, not to proclaim the knowledge of who he was at various times. Sometimes he told them to proclaim the good news of the kingdom, but often he told them not to speak publicly about him. So that has to be kept in mind, too, with regard to his statements. I think there's a change in that at a certain point in time. Well, we should probably mention at least a couple other features of the chapter. First of all, the link to Psalm 2, which is on page 233. And this enables people like Nathaniel to immediately make the connection between Son of God and King of Israel. They see both as essential elements of the Mashiach. Could someone maybe read just the relevant verses of Psalm 2? If you have them there.
Which verses do you want? I
mean, well,
I'm at Psalm 2.
1 and 2 maybe, and 6 and 7 at least.
1 and 2. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against the Anointed One. That's 1 and 2.
So that's Mashiach. Why don't you read 3 too? Why don't you just read the psalm actually? Sorry.
Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them within his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I've become your father. Ask of me. I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him.
So this psalm refers to an anointed one who is described by God as his son, mm-hmm. And who will rule the goyim, the Gentiles, the nations, mm-hmm. and will punish them for their iniquity and their rebellion. Mm-hmm. So it's very clearly linked to other messianic prophecies. Yes?
So, rabbinical Jews, don't they say God has no, maybe I'm thinking Muslims, God has no son, but, am I not right that rabbinical Jews think the Messiah is not going to be the son of God, but he's going to be a very good human being, so if that's true, who is this passage? Do they say the son is referring to?
Well, it is true that some rabbinical Jews, especially today, say that. Some rabbinical Jews say that it's a teaching of the Torah that God has no son. Mm-hmm. But that's not, just not true. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Tanakh speaks of the son or sons of God in various places, mm-hmm. like Genesis 6, in a mysterious passage. The sons of God, B'nei HaElohim, and the daughters of men. In Job, the sons of God shouted for joy. Or something like that. I might be mixing it up a little bit, but there's a reference in Job. In Proverbs, what is his name or what is his son's name? You know, the one who created the heavens. His appearance is.
Yeah. Fourth one,
like
the son of man,
or
the third one.
Right, but here also in Psalm 2, like a son of God described. So there are different ways, and I almost forgot one of the most common, where God says Israel is my firstborn son. So if you say God has no son, you're denying that Israel is God's son, which is a clear teaching of the Torah.
Yeah.
But Rabbinic Judaism has departed from the scriptures in a lot of ways. And this is one of them. And one of the reasons it has departed is in reaction to Christianity. So different modifications have been introduced into Rabbinic Jewish belief over the centuries in order to separate itself from Christianity. However, if you look into medieval Jewish beliefs, you'll be surprised at the extent to which beliefs that people today would think are Christian persisted in Jewish practice for quite a long time. And you can find in medieval times people who did believe that the Messiah would be the Son of God and would have divine elements and so forth. Today, among modern Jews, it's more common to deny that. But there's a wide range of beliefs about the Messiah even today among rabbinic Jews. But this passage speaks about the Messiah being the Son of God and being installed on Sion, in Zion. Mm-hmm. And this is explored or explained or referred to in confessions or statements like those of Nathaniel and Shimon, where they refer to him as the Messiah and the Son of the Living God and the King of Israel. So there's a backdrop for all of these statements. The backdrop is messianic prophecy. And so these statements cannot be interpreted apart from that messianic prophecy. We have to understand the messianic prophecy first, and then these statements should hopefully fall into place much more naturally. We shouldn't pick them out and then try to develop some brand new interpretation just on that basis, which is, I would say, similar to what the Catholic and Protestant interpretations were, looking at them outside of the whole scriptural context. This discussion of Psalm 2 also takes us to the last question that I wanted to look at with the chapter, and that's the question of where. It's not only who or what is the foundation, but there's a specific place, a specific location for this foundation. And we can pick this up on page 237.
Is that 2-6, Zion?
Listen, David.
Okay, well, I guess I'll just get it started, and then people can add in. Hopefully we can summarize some of these scriptures and passages here.
Is the temple located in Zion?
Yes.
That's what
the Mount Zion.
Mount Zion. Yeah.
This was all, but then when we were there, they kept talking about how Mount Zion was like the upper city. I always thought it was the temple was Mount Zion. So we taught wrong.
What do you mean?
When our tour guide was saying, okay, this is Mount Zion over here, and she wasn't talking about the temple, she was talking about the upper city, like where the upper room was and all that. And
it's the city of David.
Well, yeah, I guess that's what she said. So she kept saying that was Mount Zion, and I was always the temple, you know, the Jerusalem itself, especially the temple.
Well, it is. I mean, Zion refers to a specific hill or mountain, but it also refers to Jerusalem as a whole. Okay. And it even refers, I would say, to Eretz Yisrael as a whole as well.
Okay.
No?
I wouldn't say so. No. He says, I've never heard it used that way.
I think Zion.
Let's go up to Zion. That means Jerusalem.
Yeah, but if you're a Zionist, you support Israel.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Not just with Jerusalem, but
that's a modern translation.
Yeah, the last couple centuries it's come to mean Israel as well.
Okay.
But I mean, you see even in this passage what you were saying. I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. It's most often described as the chief mountain of Jerusalem.
And is the city of David on it or not?
City of David is adjacent to the Temple Mount. Yeah. It's side by side. In fact, what we see Golgotha today was also part of Mount Zion until Solomon built the temple. When Solomon built the temple, it made a saddle out of it and it separated Golgotha, which is outside of the city. Mm-hmm. But it was part of the mount at one time before the temple was built.
Okay, let's look then at page 237, thank you, for why this is important, actually. I'll just start reading at the top of the page. The only foundation stone that Paul knew about was Messiah. Peter was not the foundation that Paul laid, nor was Paul himself, nor was Peter's confession of faith. Yeshua is the foundation, the only foundation. Additionally, every foundation must be laid somewhere. So would anyone like to pick up from that and explain what point is being made here at the end of the chapter?
Just read this?
Well, you don't have to read it. I mean, just put it in your own words. What's the importance here of where the foundation is laid?
Foundation is laid in Zion, and Zion is the Jewish people. And that goes back to the whole thing that you can't have the foundation of Messiah without having, in a sense, the Jewish people and the Jewish faith that they already had established. Mm-hmm. You know, that God had established through them.
Okay.
It's not something new.
All right. Yeah, it's again, the whole issue of context. No one can remove God's foundation from Zion and from the city of David, from Jerusalem. So that's God's context for what he's building. Neither the Protestant nor the Catholic interpretations of the construction of this assembly include that. So if we're going to understand this verse or any other that talks about God's building company, so to speak, we have to keep in mind that part of the context as well.
They do if the context is understood that the body of Messiah started in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what is it? Matthew 28 I think, or maybe I'm thinking of Acts 1. There's some place where Yeshua says something about starting in Jerusalem and then going to Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, that's where the body of Messiah started.
Okay. But if the foundation is laid in Zion, then why is the Pope in Rome?
Well, that's one of the problems with the Catholic system.
Well, didn't there,
in other words, it's not...
The Greek Pope, is he in
Constantinople?
Yeah.
Well, there are several of them, but the originally... Constantinople, yeah, but there's Antioch and Jerusalem and so forth.
An
Armenian Pope too.
And there was your father mentioned about a Moscow Pope.
Well, they call themselves the patriarchs. The Eastern churches call them patriarchs, which is essentially the same as Pope, I guess, but it's they're viewed differently. But yeah, there are patriarchs in Russia and Bulgaria and Turkey and so forth. But
doesn't the foundation determine how the building will be laid? I mean, that's exactly what you're building, like your father was talking about building the house, the physical house,
mm-hmm.
and you hit the bedrock.
Right.
God had instituted what the foundation of the congregation would look like and on whom it would be built. Mm-hmm. He tells you about the mercy and the righteousness, how it's going to be laid. Once the foundation is laid, you cannot alter your plans, because if you do, it will crumble.
Exactly.
Your construction is only going to be good if it's built on the proper solid foundation. The foundation of our faith is built by God Himself through Mashiach. And because of that, our faith is solid and our foundation steady and secure. The foundations of interpretation of other sects of Christianity or Christianity as a whole are not built on the same rock many times. And they're built on their own prideful interpretation of what they believe the scriptures are saying to them. So, but once you have a foundation laid, you must build on top of the foundation that was laid in order to build a proper product. And I submit that our product of Messianic Judaism, of Biblical Judaism, however you want to call it, is the actual foundation to which we were supposed to find. Not the Catholic Church, not the Protestant Church, but Biblical scripture that comes only from the foundation laid by Hashem Himself.
The Psalms say that God chose Zion, and we see this in Abraham's time too. He said, "Go to a mount that I will show you, Moriah."
Exactly.
That's the same as Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And the Akedah was done there. And I brought up earlier about the Golgotha being the same mount as Mount Moriah,
mm-hmm.
before it was divided by Solomon. So this makes it even more chosen.
Oh, yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Right, and many times God spoke of choosing Jerusalem, that's the city that He has chosen to place His name in.
But so, man chose Rome, man chose wherever, Moscow.
Right.
God chose Zion.
Right, exactly, and that's in this chapter as well. There's no replacement of that foundation or of that foundation location by Rome or a second Rome or a third Rome, like Moscow. And what Bobby was saying is very important also because of the character of the building.
Right.
The character of the building is determined by the foundation as well. And the location of the foundation, of course. So it's not just an issue of, well, it started in Jerusalem and then it, you know, became transformed into something else. No, the foundation is in Zion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The foundation remains in Zion. What God is doing is in Zion in the context of what He's already promised. On page 238, the last page of the chapter, I'll just read, the Kahal or Ecclesia of God in Matthew through Revelation is the same as the Kahal Ecclesia of God in Genesis through Malachi. As we have seen, this is the commonwealth of Israel that God promised to make from Jacob as a means of bringing the rebellious Gentiles back to Himself. I'll skip down. Can we find individual Christians or local churches whose heart is towards Israel? Yes, we can. But that does not make them separate from what God is building in Israel. To the contrary, it shows them to be a part of the commonwealth of Israel, which is the topic of the next chapter. Continuing on. In the council at Jerusalem, it was determined that Gentiles who believed in Yeshua did not need to be circumcised. Why not? Because they were part of what God had promised Israel centuries before. In that day, I will restore David's fallen tent. I will repair its broken places, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the Gentiles who bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do these things. So, in other words, the rebuilding of Israel that God promises over and over through the prophets, in which he says he's accomplishing through Messiah, is for the benefit of the Gentiles, but they can't seize it and transform it into something else. They can't try to appropriate it for themselves apart from Israel. God's doing it in his way, and he's explained many, many times over and over how he's doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing that we sort of began part two with, that the calling of Israel is for the benefit of the nations, and it's not to the benefit of the nations to try to destroy Israel's calling. Christianity as an official religion has sought to destroy Israel's calling.
That's correct.
So if we join with God and agree that his promises are faithful and his prophecies will be fulfilled, then we look at the situation differently and we see the foundation that he has established in Israel, in Zion, and the foundation that he promised, the foundation stone, the cornerstone that he promised from centuries earlier.
That, I think that's what's so exciting, is you can see that he started this foundation with Abraham. Because he said, through you, all the nations will be blessed. And he started that process of gathering the parts of the building, at the very first. And the bringing together of Jew and Gentile. And if the Catholic Church, if the popes and all the popes, not just the Catholic Church, but the popes, the Protestants, and all the other miscellaneous potentates of the world were truly following the Yeshua that is found in these scriptures, they would be building up the Jewish people. They would be serving the Jewish people. They would be bringing together the Jewish people to Zion. It wouldn't be, let's do land for peace deals and kinds of nonsense.
Well, they would be seeking to enhance and support the biblical calling of the Jews.
Correct.
Right. And also, it is important to note that it's building the kingdom of God, which kind of transcends all the nations and all the geographic lines and everything that people have drawn around things.
Correct.
And so you're just going and you would be there. It is built in Jerusalem, and it will always be centered in Jerusalem, because that's where your heart and your belief is. When you look at the other locations that were chosen, Rome was chosen because it was the main seat of the Roman Empire, and it's a Roman Catholic Church that had their seat there.
Right.
So there's always this worldly part that is trying to control the spiritual part as well. The same with Constantinople, because that is where the Greek Orthodox Church had their main seat.
Well, it was the capital established by Constantine.
Exactly. The same with Moscow and all of them. It seemed more to go to the worldly leaders as well.
Definitely.
And the Anglican Church.
In
London.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And by the way, let me just add that it's a danger for any organized religion or organized ideology, whether it's Messianic Judaism or any other ism, not immune to that. And so our foundation should not be in any organization or form of religion per se, but in the scriptures and what God himself has said.
Absolutely.
And so what does he say? Well, God promises that the Messiah from Israel's royal house, the house of David, would be raised up and would rule over the Gentiles who bear my name. So it is an actual rule. It will be political in a sense, but it will be different from the political rule from Rome or Constantinople or Moscow. It will be a righteous rule, as we read before. In accordance with God's will. But notice also that all of these prophecies talk about Gentiles. In other words, these people are still Gentiles. They are part of the Goyim. They have not become Jews. They are not proselytes. But they will bear the name of the God of Israel, the one who establishes David's kingdom. So the last paragraph here. The apostles understood the gathering in of the Gentiles to be the fulfillment of what God had promised to their fathers, to Israel, and to Israel's royal house. They rejoiced to see the gathering in of the Gentiles, even though at first they did not understand it. For them, Israel was and remained the only context that God had provided for the salvation of all peoples, and the only context that God needed. There is only one foundation, and it has been laid in only one place. So I think that's a more scriptural presentation than the other ones, the other interpretations that have been devised that we've discussed. Mm-hmm. And what this Commonwealth of Israel that includes Gentiles is will be discussed in the next chapter.